Hey guys, I'm Mark Potter, and welcome to another episode of Brushstrokes, a podcast powered by Canvas Magazine. Guys, today's episode is brought to you by my really good friends at Fujifilm. I'm not sure if you realize, but Fujifilm's J-Press 750S delivers unsurpassed levels of productivity. The all-new third-generation J-Press 750S is now here and available. People are placing them, and it's really, really cool stuff. It's got an unsurpassed level of productivity. It can generate 3,600 B2 sheets per hour for both static and variable jobs. It's been known as the jet press outside of North America, but they began offering this digital inkjet series for the commercial printing field, I think back in 2011. So it is not your mama's Fujifilm, right? We all know them as pressroom suppliers, and they've been a staple to the industry. But the stuff they're doing with wide format, the stuff they're doing with inkjet is really, really cool. So if you get a chance, check out the 750S, and I think you'll love it. Guys, today's conversation is with a fellow Browns fan, believe it or not. I can't believe I admit that. It's going to be a big year for us. But I do have the pleasure of talking with David Foreman. He's a partner at Tonkentorp LLP. They are a law firm out of Portland, and they are specializing in mergers and acquisitions. So that's kind of near and dear to our hearts, if you will, because we've had a lot of mergers and acquisitions in our industry. We have a lot of people who are looking to buy or sell. I think we've got groups of people who are looking to move on. And we also have a lot of you out there that are looking to invest in different types of organizations. So kind of a cool perspective, but he is a good talker, and which is great. And this is not a stale attorney. This is someone who is in the mix and is passionate about putting people together and ultimately doing the right thing. It's not about just going through the details and slapping stuff together. So I think you're really going to love this conversation with David Foreman. He is a partner again at Tonkentorp, and give it a listen. Enjoy. David.
Good morning, Mark.
How are you?
I'm doing pretty well.
Yeah, how are things on the West Coast?
So, things on the West Coast today are, well, Pacific Northwest are cloudy and gray, so it's a typical day, but yesterday for the 4th is beautiful. This weekend in Portland is the Waterfront Blues Festival, and
oh, cool.
It gets better and better every year.
Oh my gosh, so that's awesome.
Yeah, yesterday was a terrific day for it, too.
So do you...
Fireworks, you know, at the end of the night.
Oh, yeah. Do you start that today? You got friends and family going to it?
Started yesterday because they tried to do the big fireworks on the 4th. And I've got a crew of friends that one day it's sports, the next day it's music. And without anybody even communicating with anybody, everybody just knew where to show up.
That's great. Cool. That's awesome. That's awesome.
So I don't know. Oh, go ahead.
No, I just, you know what? I don't know what kind of music is it?
Well, it's a blues festival, so it tends to be traditional blues, new blues. Yesterday I saw Vanessa Collier, who's an up-and-coming artist. And she was terrific. She would probably be in the new blues category.
Oh, cool.
And then, you know, it's a little bit on the fringes of that, too. There was some acoustic, but it's pretty geared towards the blues. If you get to ever hear Ron Ortiz from Hawaii, Ron Ortiz and the Truth, he's just a phenomenal performer. But the bigger festival, I should say bigger, but we have another music festival coming up here in a month. Called Pickathon, and it's not just picking, it's a very eclectic festival with all up-and-coming artists. And I get to be backstage concierge for a couple of the stages, so
that's cool. That's a treat. That's awesome. That's fantastic.
And training camp starts.
Yeah. I don't know. I you know what? I'm You and I obviously share an affliction, and
yes,
and it is that of the Cleveland Browns. And I don't know. For years they just kind of drove you away. After a while, I was like, you'd check in on them to see if they were doing anything. But I grew up a diehard, and but for the first time in a long time, they've got some interesting things going on. I mean, it sounds like they've got a little bit of hope, huh?
Yeah. So I haven't lived in Cleveland since the mid-80s or sometime around then. I moved to Portland, Oregon from New York City in 1993. I became a season ticket holder in 1999 when they came back.
Oh, wow.
So I've been a season ticket holder since 1999, haven't lived in Cleveland since the mid-80s. And I don't know, I mean, if someone, I'm sure there's probably a lot of people out there who think that's the definition of insanity. it's a true affliction. But you're right. I think this year, some good things are finally going to happen. I mean, I never go to the games. I donate the tickets every year to the Tickets for Kids Foundation.
Oh, cool.
And yeah, I I've been to maybe 5 or 6 games since 1999. I think I sat in the seats once. So I donate the tickets every weekend. But this year I actually have a bunch of people wanting to go. And frankly, I'm not sure the Tickets for Kids Foundation always uses the tickets I donate.
Right.
So what I think I'm going to do this year is I'm going to probably sell a couple at face value and then use that money to donate to local Portland organizations that have kids programs or focus on kids. So, there's no point going back to, there hasn't been a point to go back to a Cleveland Browns game. And I don't even know how long.
Forever.
So,
since you got the tickets. Forever. Yeah. No, I don't. First of all, I think it's great that obviously you're involved in a lot of outside stuff, you know, with the music, and sounds like you've got some passion around supporting kids, and which I think is great, and probably why you're successful. So we'll talk about that in a minute. But on the other hand, both my kids are locked into hockey, and my son and I were talking. I said, yeah, I don't know if we could ever find the time. We'll have to play it by ear during this year and see if how they do and if we ever get a moment, because every weekend is always booked. So,
But
it shows you, I mean, there's an analogy in there somewhere, right? I mean, mm-hmm. You can talk about hope, you can talk about, loyalty, you know, guys like us, we're loyal. I mean, there's still some lessons in that. So, that's so cool. That's so cool. Well, I appreciate you taking some time and I know we've interviewed you for, an article on mergers and acquisitions, and I thought we could use some of this time and just kind of get your take on some of that. And
sure.
Maybe you can, before we jump into that, give me a little 411. That's still relevant, I think, to people like us. But I tell that to
I do remember what 411 stands for. Yes,
that's right. I told that to a young person who works for us, and they looked at me cross-eyed. So, but you know, give me the David Foreman 411, and then tell me a little bit about Tonkin.
Sure. The David Foreman 411, I'm a business transaction lawyer. I focus on two things, growth capital and mergers and acquisitions. And I work with a number of different types of businesses in different industries. I do a lot of work here in the startup community, and the focus there is bioscience and food and beverage, and don't ask how those two came together. But really what I tell people my job is, I make clients investor buyer friendly and diligence ready.
Oh, wow.
That's my job, is is if you're looking at doing a deal, I help you become investor buyer friendly and diligence ready.
So what do you think the what are the key components in being investor buyer ready?
Really, the key component from, well, it depends. It's a great question, and it depends on what you're doing. So a lot of my startup clients, for them, it's all about command of your presentation, command of your industry, and making sure from more of a legal perspective that that you've got things sort of buttoned up from a you've created a platform that's investor ready, meaning that you're in the right structure, you have control over your IP, and I can go on from there. But when you're talking more M&A, it's a much deeper process. Mm-hmm. And because you've, at that point, you've got a history of operating. So at that point, it's from a legal perspective, it's really making sure, you know, you've got, from a legal perspective, you've got all your contracts signed, you have all your corporate records up to date. But on a sort of a bigger scale, mm-hmm. it's really about planning. On a bigger scale, it's really about planning. It's really make sure you've taken the time to think through the whole process and what your goal and what your goals are, and just work towards that. M&A is, I love it. It's, even though it's become in a way sort of structured, and what I mean by that is there's a beginning and an end, and the framework is pretty much the same these days because there's just been so much activity over the last few years. Mm-hmm. No two companies are alike, and the things that present themselves are always different. So there's just always creativity that goes into it.
Yeah.
So to be investor friendly, diligence ready from an M&A point of view, you really have to be planning for about a year, year and a half before really hitting the market. And that's everything from the legal side of stuff to just making sure your business operations are, you know, are buttoned down. You know, there's a lot more to it than that, but that's sort of the high level.
Yeah.
And then you asked about Tonkin.
Yeah.
So Tonkin is a 90-person law firm, which is on the larger side for Portland, Oregon, but obviously very small from a financial center point of view. Mm-hmm. We're split pretty much 50-50 between business and litigation. We excel at private company mid-market M&A. In fact, although we're a single office Portland firm, we get a lot of calls from people outside of Portland, and because I think companies realize that, again, you know, there's M&A is not rocket science. You don't really need to spend $1,000 for an associate in a financial center when there's firms, and not just in Portland and other cities, that are extremely experienced in the M&A space, who are way more efficient at a much lower cost. So we see a lot of that as well, but we excel at mid-market private company M&A, and we also excel at the entrepreneurial growth, you know, startup growth capital transactions, as well as helping, you know, new companies get funded,
right.
And how to structure those deals as well.
I was just going to say, I mean, when you get into these things, you know, there's the nuts and bolts, and I want to kind of come back to that and ask you a little bit about planning and advice and negotiating and all that kind of stuff. But do you guys, I don't know if you get involved with or at least have a perspective on some of the cultural stuff that goes on around M&A, and where you've seen, you know, have you ever seen stuff like that, you know, gosh, do you know this isn't going to work because culturally they're just polar opposites, or do you see any of that after, like, the post-mortem kind of stuff?
Yeah, all the time.
Yeah.
That's part of the planning process. You really have to know who you are. And so, you know, we're Portland, Oregon. I've been doing this for 30 years now, you know, 25 of it or something like that in Portland. Most of my life has been selling Oregon businesses to out-of-state buyers.
Mm-hmm.
But the reason why I bring that up, your question is, the buy side is a little different from the sell side. I mean, if you're a buyer, you really have to do due diligence on the culture of the organization you're buying, because, you know, if there are apples and your oranges, I don't care how good the businesses are, it's just not going to work.
Right.
And from the sell side, you really, you know, it depends on the objectives of the owners. I mean, if the owners are looking just to get out and be done, you know, that's one thing. But if the owners are looking to either to continue or to preserve a legacy, it's just really important to go beyond just the financials and just, you know, look under the hood to see how your buyer, you know, runs its business. Or if it's a financial buyer, look to see what portfolio companies that they've brought in, and, you know, go talk to some of their portfolio companies, because to your point, culture is huge. I mean, culture is absolutely huge.
Yeah.
You can have two perfectly good cultures that are completely different, and it's going to be really hard to integrate. And that's where planning comes in.
Mm-hmm.
You just have to spend the time thinking through this, because you don't want to wake up the day after closing and find out that, you know, things are just different.
Right.
That can ruin what otherwise looked like a really good deal on paper.
Well, I've always wanted to ask. There's these acquisitions that occur where they buy somebody and they keep the owner on, and they do a contract of some sort. You know, hey, we're keeping it on for 3 years. And I've seen it, you know, obviously in the printing and graphic arts industry, you know, over the course of the last 10, 15 years, I mean, there's been a whole slew of mergers and acquisitions. Mm-hmm. I mean, the whole thing went, you know, there was a time when we had 50,000 commercial printers. I mean, we're down to, we may be less than 20 now, but, And a lot of them have come together, but I have seen countless owners be absorbed and then sign the contract. And then, you know, they're rarely sitting there going, oh my God, I just love it. It's been great. You know, it's like I see all these times when they just want to get out or I don't know why do they, I mean, obviously the acquirer is going to do that. To say, look, you understand the inner workings, you understand the book of business, but that doesn't always work out, does it?
No, it doesn't. But it's really hard for a buyer to buy a business and not have the people who really understand the business be there for some kind of transition. I will tell you, 3 years is probably too long,
right.
Especially if it's an owner in the, you know, at the end of the career. This goes to the planning process as well. I mean, you know, good leaders always have a succession plan. So if you're an owner, you want to sell, and it's not your desire to be stuck with a 3-year transition plan because the buyer thinks you're the only source of information,
mm-hmm.
You know, build a really solid team around you, because one, you're going to need that to get through the process anyway. True, that enhances, at least it maintains value, but probably enhances value. And three, you may not be stuck having to be the, you know, you may not be stuck with being a part of the, you know, the, to your point, the deal doesn't happen without that owner being on for 2 or 3 years.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe if you planned a little bit better, you can get out from under that deal requirement. But a lot of the time it works. It doesn't work for 3 years, but it also depends on what's happening, right? I mean, if you've got a printing business that's looking to grow and they see their only growth opportunity through being acquired, then a lot of times that management team, including the CEO and the owner, wants to continue. And it's just because they've got a better platform now.
Right. Right.
But if you're talking about the, you know, the person who, you know, ended the career, you know, isn't really that interested in showing up every day, then it's really hard. And then it's incumbent on that person to build a solid team.
Yeah. Well, and that's a really valid point. I, you know, you've got some leaders who, if they're getting acquired, you know, maybe that's part of it, right? They're getting acquired for all the right reasons. They're saying, look, this is a up and coming company, and the company who's the selling or being absorbed, that leader may say, look, I can't do this by myself. Having these guys acquire us is the best thing. I want to be a part of it. So, yeah, my guess is there are fewer of those than because, look, there's a lot of egos in the world. But I was just curious. From your perspective, obviously you guys get into a lot of the details and stuff, but I'm sure that the stuff that falls through or the stuff that presents the biggest challenge is that cultural stuff, you know?
Yes. Yeah. So I'm going to go out on a limb here, and I don't know this for a fact. I know it anecdotally. I'm going to go on a limb and say a lot of your a lot of the businesses in your space have probably been family-run businesses.
Yes.
Or, you know, and that's a whole nother challenge, because a lot of times in family-run businesses, you do have the owner who's really been the entire business for a long period of time.
Right.
So that's probably why you're seeing that that situation happening post-closing. And that goes to the point where, you know, there's a lot of egos involved, but if you're an owner and you've got an end game, your end game is an exit, you really do need to think beyond yourself and build out a team that really can help you just build the business. And it's succession planning one way or the other.
Right.
But we see more of the problem you're describing in sort of family or closely held businesses.
Oh yeah.
For Oregon, that's a very big part of what Tonkin Torp does, because a lot of our businesses here have been, you know, second, third, fourth generation type traditional businesses. We don't see that so much in the growth capital that from companies that have gone through growth capital through an exit, because the whole part of going through growth capital is building a team. It's almost the number one requirement of investment.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a little bit of a different situation, but I would assume in your industry, you see that a lot.
Oh my gosh. Yeah. I mean, you know,
yeah.
And there is a lot of, there's a growing faction of companies that traditionally known as printers or what we call print service providers. And right. Not only can they be acquired and merged and stuff, they're acquiring, right? But they might be acquiring.
Yeah.
I've got some very, very good clients and people we know that are, you know, acquiring agencies or smaller type specialty printing in companies. And so, you know, those seem to work really, really well, right? They're incorporating mm-hmm. them, and it's a new offering. It's when you're taking two companies or two printers, and you know, a lot of times when they're this exact same size, they do exactly the same thing, and maybe one is struggling, or maybe they're, you know, the sum of two of them is better than them separate. But that's, I think, where you see some of the cultural stuff. But you know, we have an industry that is, quite honestly, there obviously there's a lot of industries aging, and in ours is doing that. Like I said, you've got some faction that is, you know, going out of business, some that are just merging to merge, but then there's other ones that are in this growth mindset where they're acquiring in these different things. So it is an industry full of this right now, and that's why I think it was important to kind of have you here and get some of your thoughts and your advice and about the process, and so that's great. Let me ask you a question. So, I mean, because when we interviewed you for the article, you had some really cool things to say, and I was fascinated with your take on negotiating. And I think you even used a story of someone who got to the table, and I think at the table they requested a 5% decrease, and the other people got up and walked away. So
yeah, that was that's one of my favorite war stories.
That's great. Well, what are the lessons there? When you think about being, you know, cause it's like anything, even if you're buying a house, I mean, there's right. a lot of nerves going on. So talk to me a little bit about negotiating.
Well, let me just, By the way, just a digression here. Whatever had did the article ever get printed?
It's no, it's in process. It's going out. Yeah, it's going. It's sponsored by Fujifilm and is going out. So it's it could be on press right now.
That's funny. Okay, so back to your question. Negotiation is a broad topic, but I'm gonna take that story and. Because a lot of deals get done in the end for emotional reasons, right? It's been you spent 3, 6, 9 months, sometimes a year, year and a half on this process, and at some point you just want to get it done.
Mm-hmm.
You just want to get it done, but you always have to be able to walk away. Always have to be able to walk away, and. Because if you get, I think you mentioned a few minutes ago that some companies were merging to merge.
Mm-hmm.
That's never a good idea. If it doesn't hit your gut in the appropriate way, you have to be able to walk away. And negotiating is, in some ways, is the art of listening. The beauty about for me, one of the reasons I've liked M&A over these years. I've rarely been in a situation where it wasn't a win-win for both sides.
Right.
And so if everybody's approaching this as, it's a win-win for both sides, then it's just a question of listening to see what the other side needs or wants and figuring out how that works for you and making sure you're expressing what your needs or your wants are. And if it doesn't feel good, just you have to be able to walk away.
Right.
I don't know if that answers your question, but these days, in terms of the actual legal documents, there's so much information on the internet right now about, about this provision shows up in 67% of the deals, and this provision shows up in, or nobody asks for this anymore. I mean, there's so much information out there.
Mm-hmm.
That sort of the structure of the agreements are. And now there's 3 or 4 agreements or forms that everybody uses. So from that point of view, the level of negotiation has become more rote, if you will, or routine, where the magic is structuring the deal and structuring the economics of the deal. And, no deal should ever get done just for the sake of getting it done. I mean, it should get done for all the right reasons. So people, you have to be able to say, this isn't right. This doesn't feel good. It's not going to work for me. And I'm just, there's going to be another deal out there.
Right.
Yeah. So I don't know if that's what you were asking.
Yeah.
The negotiation is such a huge, huge, huge concept that I wasn't sure,
It is a huge guy. I'm curious, and it's interesting to hear you say that. Listen, it's just got to hit your gut right, and it's got to be right, and that's kind of nice to hear, because I wonder, and if I'm sure you've seen this, because we've had so much over the course. I would say over the last 20 years. Heck, I was part of a .com years ago, And it was just this drive to get a deal done. It was this drive to sell a company, right? I mean, there were stock options, mm-hmm. and all this kind of stuff. And so I think we collectively saw all that. I don't know if you call it excess or whatever. And I wonder if you see that. I mean, it's nice to hear that we're maybe they're on the other side of that now, where you're like, listen, you have to build businesses with a purpose, and the purpose is not to necessarily merge it or sell it or whatever. And that might be a byproduct, a happy byproduct at some point, but hopefully there's a mission or a purpose to it all. And I wondered if you've seen a change, because I'm sure there was a time when it was like, oh, people just want to launch .coms and get them merged and do, and maybe we're now on the other side of it.
All depends on the industry, and it all depends on how you're going through the growth cycle. So again, I do a lot of growth capital. I work with a lot of startups that are out there raising money. If you take money from investors, you're telling investors that you're going to sell the company in 3, 5, 7 years, because right. no one's going to give you money unless you tell them how they're going to get their money back.
Right.
So it just really depends on how you plan on financing your business. I've seen a lot of people recently that have, you know, understand that curve, but have said, you know what, I want this to be different. This, you know, I think I can do this on my own and build it up and, you know, make it a nice business. I've other people like, no, in order for this to be successful, we have to be first to market. In order to be first to market, we need to get, you know, investor capital in. And we know if we get investor capital in, that means we're, you know, we're looking at an exit in 3, 5, 7 years. Having said that, that's also part of the whole, you know, growth and growth strategy, because at that point, you're hopefully looking for just another buyer that that's just going to give you a better platform to continue to grow the business. But it's been interesting to see, you know, I can't tell you over the last couple of years what's, you know, what, because we've seen strategics, we've seen financial buyers. I don't know, for us, there hasn't been a rhyme or reason to it. But to your point, it really depends. There's some industries like your industry where it's been mostly organic growth over the years. And I think those folks are coming to the realization that let's build the business first and worry about the deal later.
Mm-hmm.
But the folks that are going through the growth capital, you know, and that's mostly tech. Those folks are making a public announcement. Thank you for your investor dollars. We understand that we will be selling this company soon.
Right. Yeah, I think that's great. Well, let me ask you. So, because we asked you this before, but I thought this was interesting, is because negotiation, obviously is an issue. Culture is certainly an issue after the fact. Yeah. And, you know, you talk about planning, that type of thing. But one of the things that you had told us that you could maybe elaborate on a little bit is that you see some owners, while they're trying to get this deal done, take their eye off the ball of running their business.
Oh yeah. So, and I experience that almost all the time. And that goes to building a team too, right? I mean, you can't, so capability, capacity, and planning. Those are the three things that are very important going into a deal. I mean, and it's different, and those things mean different things if you're buy side or sell side. But to your question, let's take it from the sell side point of view. When you decide to enter the process, you have two jobs, two full-time jobs. One is managing the process. The other is running your business. And if you try to do, if you're an owner and you're trying to do both of those, something's going to give.
Mm-hmm.
And it's usually the business. And it's usually the business. And so you've done this fantastic, and I see this a lot, unfortunately. And it's because the owner doesn't have people around them to either help support the business or help support the deal, whichever. But, you know, if you've spent your entire career building up value, you get to the finish line and you've basically let your business atrophy over the last 12 months because, you know, and it doesn't atrophy in 12 months, but, you know, you either flatlined it. Well, that's not the right term. I mean, you haven't pushed sales. You haven't continued pushing growth. You just sort of let it run its course.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you're doing a disservice to your company in the deal because frankly, at some point that's going to come back to bite you, either in purchase price value or, you know, post closing, that, you know, the business has to play catch up.
Right.
And I'm in a situation now where the owner is, you know, everything, chief bottle washer, and has been working on a deal for 6 months, has not put the resources that normally one would put into the business, whether it's sales, marketing, whatever, the buyer may or may not be able to fund this deal. And if the buyer can't fund it, the deal's not going to close. And basically, this owner has wasted a year of growing the business.
Right.
So, you have to have capability. You have to have capacity. Capability is, and again, buy side, sell side is a little different. Capability is just the ability to know how to navigate the merger and acquisition process. Capacity is, just capacity. It's the time management to do it. Mm-hmm. And you can't spend your time running the business and running a deal process. You have to have a team supporting you both. And then planning is just to make sure that, at the end of the day, once the deal is done, and that's, making sure there's a cultural fit to stuff we've already talked about, to a number of things, making sure that once the deal is closed, you've thought through all the integration issues and cultural issues to, again, create a successful platform to keep the business growing.
Right.
I probably said this in the article, but, it's real estate, it's location, location, location. In M&A, it's integration, integration, integration. Right. Unless you've taken the time to plan for integration, understanding cultural fit, understanding the synergies, your deal's in jeopardy.
Yeah. So, well, and it's funny. I mean, such a valid point around keeping your eye on the ball, because for exactly the reason that you're talking about, that example you just mentioned, that guy, not only has he not grown the business, but he's potentially damaged his brand for a longer time, right? Because he's,
yeah, absolutely.
I got to be honest. Yeah. I've got some people I know that have put together companies and they've, I don't know if that was all their focus, but they're struggling now. And because if you're going to go through and not necessarily serve your clients because you've been focused on putting this deal together, you may not gain a lot of business, but eventually they say, well, now it's even worse because things were going bad, and now I don't even know who you put this thing together with. So it really does make sense that you still have to take care of the business. You're not working right at a finish line.
No, well, in the situation I was describing, this owner took the eye off the ball, and a competitor has entered the marketplace.
Mm.
So even if the deal goes through. The business, whether it's the new integrated business or whatever, they got to play catch up to this competitor and no other reason that the owner was so focused on getting the deal done that allowed, didn't put up the barriers to entry over the last year and a half to prevent someone from somebody else coming in and taking market share. So, so even if the deal gets done, if you've taken your eye off the ball, you're playing catch up after that. So, I'm watching this happen. This owner has advisors. Obviously this person's been speaking with me for a while, and everybody has advised this person, you gotta have people around you either to run the business or run the deal.
Yeah.
But you can't do both, because here's what's going to happen. Well, we wish we weren't predictors of this, because we, would prefer it didn't happen. But, it happened just as everybody said it was going to happen.
Absolutely. So. Absolutely. Well, listen, I don't want to keep you from the music, but I do have one last question, and then, maybe a couple last things here.
I blocked out till 11, if that helps you.
Excellent. Hard decisions. Maybe you can talk about hard decisions. And a lot of times those hard decisions probably center around people, because you're not
always.
You're right. You're not
always.
And I have, like I said, I have friends who have put companies together, and I really feel like they were unable to make hard decisions. There's a lot of redundancy. And it's strapped them, and it's one and one isn't going to equal 2, but maybe it's 1.75, but you got to have a better cost structure. And if you keep the cost structure, 1 and 1 is going to equal 1.75 with the same cost. It doesn't make any sense. So, you know, I'm assuming you've seen that. And what advice do you have for people around hard decisions? And it doesn't just have to be about people, but you know what I'm saying.
It's always about people.
Yeah.
The hardest decisions are always about people.
Right.
Yeah. You know, from a number of reasons, you know, sometimes, you know, owners aren't quick to recognize whether someone's a fit. Sometimes owners, well, here's what I always, it always makes me feel good when owners look down the road and say, I've got this great group of people that have worked for me all these years. And, you know, I want to preserve a legacy and I want to make sure that they're taken care of. And that's why it's important to really vet your buyers.
Mm-hmm.
But the hard decisions are usually that, you know, it's always around people. This isn't just M&A. I mean, as a manager, you have to decide early on whether or not someone is, you know, capable of the job that you want him or her to do.
Right.
And if they're not, you gotta rip the Band-Aid off.
Yeah.
You just have to, because if you don't, it in the M&A context, it creates problems for the deal, because you've got buyers who are looking at, you know, how you're managing your business, because when they're doing management team presentations, they know very quickly, they get a very quick read on personnel issues. But this is really not an M&A. It's just really, you know, running your business. If you've got people that are not producing for whatever reason, you have to make the hard decision quickly, because if you don't, it just festers.
Right.
And it does create problems as you're going into a transaction, because you do want to have a management team around you that, at the end of the day, whether you're doing growth capital or you're selling to a financial buyer, investors and buyers are management team first, product or concept second. I mean, buyers would rather buy, and investors would rather invest in a phenomenal management team, mm-hmm. and a mediocre product than a phenomenal product and a mediocre management team. Because if you got a phenomenal product but you can't execute on the business plan, it doesn't do anybody any good. So I know I'm sort of not, I haven't quite got there yet on the answer, because it's really not an M&A issue. It's really about, it's just really about managing your business. If you've got people that that aren't pulling their weight or are in way over their head, everybody else around the team can see it, and it creates, it's a cultural issue at the end of the day.
Mm-hmm.
Because you're creating a culture where you know, people just recognize that stuff, and I don't think you're helping the person who isn't performing either. I mean, you're not doing that person any favors either. And this may sound harsh, but you got to take care of those situations very quickly. I was speaking to an owner the other day. She just sold her business. She literally spent a year and a half trying to figure out what to do with one particular senior manager.
Mm-hmm.
And she's a mission-driven business. Her one advice was, I learned a lot. Now that I know this, I would have done something differently a year and a half ago than having it strung out like this, because it created a problem throughout the whole organization.
Mm-hmm.
Throughout the whole management team, because everybody, everybody understands what's going on. It's hard to keep that kind of stuff under wraps.
Oh, yeah.
But people are always the hardest decision. the just in the M&A context, the other sort of hard decision is just letting go. And knowing that it's kind of like raising a kid. At some point, it's you. The teacher becomes more influential than the parent.
Right.
It's very true. It's very true. At some point, you have to know when it's time to get out of the way. And founder syndrome is something I deal with almost every day. Knowing that there's someone else better than you to take your company to the next level. And that's really, 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 really hard for people to know that, you know what, I did a great job raising this from, you know, one employee to 100 or from $1 million to $30 million. And knowing that I may not be the best person to take this from, you know, $30 million to $100 million or from 100 employees to 200 employees. I think if all that other stuff we talked about, people, that, you know, that's outside the M&A context. But in terms of thinking about when it's time to sell or when it's time to bring someone else in to put you in a position to sell, I think that awareness is the hardest thing for founders. Just knowing when your skill set has, you've taken the company as far as you can, and someone with a different skill set, you need to bring someone else in with that different skill set to take it from there.
Right.
That's probably the hardest decision I deal with founders and owners every day.
Well, I think that's spot on. It's great advice. Let me ask you, so now you've spurred one more question. And so when you talk about people who, again, whether it's investors or one company buying another, that's really, really interesting to me, because a funny thing is we were just going through some editorial stuff here and for one of our magazines, and we were talking about an idea for an article, and it is essentially around ideas. I mean, ideas are a dime a dozen, and it all comes down to execution. And so it's interesting to me that someone might say, look, that's an attractive company, whether it's based on market share or based on something that they do technology-wise or a market they serve. But ultimately, you're saying, look, that's akin to an idea. It's going to be the management team that is attractive. So with that, my question is, what typically are they looking for in that management team? What makes them attractive?
Couple things. Industry experience, industry knowledge, demonstrated ability to execute on a business plan. The CFO has to have good command of the business plan and the strategy around it. Frankly, it's different at different stages. At the early stage, what a lot of investors look for is a leader who understands what his or her skill sets are and what team she or he needs to build around that. Mm-hmm. At the M&A stage, it's literally, and they get this in what's called management presentations. I'll come back to that. You know, they're looking for people who have confidence and demonstrated ability to have gotten the business to this far, and the ability to, you know, to execute on the plan and move it forward.
Right.
It's a really good question, because honestly, and I've asked this before, I don't think there's a clear answer.
Okay.
So it's funny, just a little tidbit piece of advice. If you're going through a process, you're going to have what are called management presentations, meaning, you know, a whole bunch of people are going to express interest in your company, and you're going to select about 10 to 12 of them, even though that's a lot, to come in and interview you. And the one thing you want to do, it's like any other interviewing process, start with the ones with the buyers that are not the best fit, because you want to make sure you've practiced this and been coached by either your investment banker or your advisors. So if you're looking at 6 to 7 or 8 different potential buyers, and there's 3 that you love and 2 like, yeah, you're not so crazy about, do the ones that you're not so crazy about first, because you know, again, because if you flub the management presentations, then that's going to make the deal really hard. So that, to the point about what they're looking for, when that's what they're looking for is command of the business, command of the industry, mm-hmm. command of the growth, and an ability to articulate it in a very concise and precise way. So the management presentations are key, because that's where you're being interviewed by the buyers, and things can go things can go incredibly well, or you can completely blow it in the management presentation. So it's command of the business, command of industry, command of the growth plan. And an ability to articulate it.
Yeah, I think that's great. That's fantastic advice. I think it's really good stuff. And we may need to reach back out to you, because I have not only, you know, do we have a following that's going through this as an industry, but we've got a lot of clients and specific relationships that that could use your advice. Which begs the thing, before I let you go off to listen to some good music, tell the listeners how they could find you, and if they had questions or were interested.
Yeah, and just so for the listeners out there, I really enjoy this, and I love answering questions about this. So if people have questions and just say, hey, does this make sense, or what should I expect? I'm more than happy to answer those.
Yeah.
I know our firm, given its makeup, has represented printers and printing companies in the past. So there's people in the office with experience in the industry.
Yeah.
But you can reach me. My phone number is 503-802-2023. My email is david.forman, F as in Frank, O-R-M-A-N, at Tonkin. It's T as in Tom, O-N as in Nancy, K as in Kangaroo, O-N as in Nancy.com, david.forman at Tonkin.com. It's interesting times. The M&A market is unbelievably hot. But I will also, probably in closing, I think if you haven't gotten into the pipeline this year, I think it'll be a challenge. I don't think people have the resources to pay attention to more, you know, buyers don't have the resources to pay attention to more deals at this point. Mm-hmm. It's fun times in M&A. Anyway, I'd be happy to answer questions somebody's been beeping me for the last 5 minutes.
That's good. Well, that's a good thing. Maybe there's some question, you know, maybe it's some new activity. Listen, I can't thank you enough, David, for doing this. It's been great. I hope you have a blast at the festival, and we need to ping each other throughout the season. Hopefully there'll be joyous communication as opposed to what we've endured over the last 20 years. But I'm glad that we're kindred spirits in that respect. And I just can't thank you enough for this. I think the listeners are going to love it, and they will. We'll put it out, and if they've got questions, they'll get in touch with you.
Sounds good. Nice chatting, and I will be in touch throughout the season.
You got it. All right, David. Have a good time.
Bye, Mark.
See ya. Guys, I hope you enjoyed my conversation with David Forman. He's the partner at Tonkin Torp out of Portland, Oregon. And I think that it was pretty compelling stuff. He was talking a lot about planning, culture, hard decisions, negotiating, some of the stuff that you take maybe for granted, but it's really all about it. The merger and acquisition process is not simply about finding somebody who's ripe or finding necessarily just the synergies and the details of the business. It's about putting together the right culture and strategy to make it happen. And I thought it was really compelling to hear him talk about the management team and what people are looking for. So I just can't thank David enough for spending some time with us, and hopefully he went on to enjoy his music festival. That today's podcast was brought to you by, again, my friends at Fujifilm. I think a lot of what they're doing with Inkjet, and specifically the 750S. It is now their flagship digital inkjet press, and it's taken core technologies from its 720S and raised the bar with a series of innovations, productivity, and environmental enhancements. So I think you should check it out if you're in the market. Again, this is not the Fujifilm that we've always known. They're actually even more. They're still a great friend to the press room, but they are now an even greater friend to the industry by offering this type of technology. So my thanks to them for sponsoring, and my thanks to you for listening. I hope you enjoyed this episode of Brushstrokes. I look forward to our next one, and until then, be the buffalo. Take care.